much earlier. From 1923 forward, the Fed's open market operations have been carried out by the New York Federal Reserve Bank. The money trust has always been in control. Drowning in credit. Actions have consequences, and one of the consequences of purchasing treasury bonds and other debt-related securities in the open market is that the money created to purchase them eventually ends up in the commercial banks, where it is used for the expansion of bank credit. Credit is another of those weaselly words that have different meanings to different people. In banker language, the expansion of credit means the banks have excess reserves, bookkeeping entries, which can be multiplied by 9 and earn interest for them, if only someone would be kind enough to borrow. It is money waiting to be created. The message is, come on to the bank, folks, don't be bashful. We've got plenty of money to lend. You have credit you didn't even know you had. In the 1920s, the greater share of bank credit was bestowed upon business firms, wealthy investors, and other high rollers. But the little man was not ignored. In 1910, consumer credit accounted for only 10% of the nation's retail sales. By 1929, credit transactions were responsible for half of the $60 billion retail market. In his book, Money and Man, Elgin Grosclose says, by 1929, the United States was overwhelmed by a flood of credit. It had covered the land. It was pouring into every nook and cranny of the national economy. The impact of expanding credit was compounded by artificially low interest rates, the other side of the same coin, which were intended to help the governments of Europe. But they also stimulated borrowing here at home, since borrowing is what causes money to be created under fractional reserve banking. The money supply in America began to expand. From 1921 through June of 1929, the quantity of dollars increased by 61.8%, substantially more than the increase in national product. During that same time, the amount of currency in circulation remained virtually unchanged. That means the expansion was comprised entirely of money substitutes, such as bonds and loan contracts. Booms and busts made worse. The forces of the free market are amazingly flexible. Like the black market, they manage to exert themselves in unexpected ways in spite of political decree. That had been the case throughout most of American history. Prior to the creation of the Federal Reserve, banking had been coddled and hobbled by government. Banks were chartered by government, protected by government, and regulated by government. They had been forced to serve the political agendas of those in power. Consequently, the landscape was strewn with the tombstones of dead banks which had taken to their graves the life savings of their hapless depositors. But these were mostly regional tragedies that were offset by growth and prosperity in other areas. Even within the communities most severely affected, recovery was swift. Now that the cartel had firm control over the nation's money supply, the pattern began to change. The corrective forces of the free market were more firmly straitjacketed than ever. All banks in the entire country were in lockstep with each other. What happened in one region is what happened in all regions. Banks were not allowed to die, so there could be no adjustments after their demise. Their illness was sustained and carried like a deadly virus to the others. The expansion of the money supply in the 1920s clearly shows that effect. It was not a steady advance, but a series of convulsions. Each cycle was at a higher level than the previous one. That is because the busts that followed the booms were not allowed to play themselves out. The monetary scientists now had so many mechanisms at their command, they were able to initiate new expansions to cancel out the downward adjustments. It was like prescribing increasing doses of narcotics to postpone the awareness of an advancing disease. It increased the prestige of the doctor, but it did not bode well for the patient. The roller coaster. Between 1920 and 1929, there were three distinct business cycles with several minor ones within them. For the average American, it was confusing and destructive. For the investor, it was a roller coaster ride to oblivion. Up. The Fed had inflated the money supply to pay for World War I. The resulting boom caused prices to rise. Down. In 1920, the Fed raised interest rates to cool off the inflation. That caused a recession, and prices tumbled. Farmers were hit the hardest, and hundreds of country banks were closed. Up. In 1921, the Fed lowered interest rates to stop the recession and to help the governments of Europe. Inflation and expanding debt resulted. Down. In 1923, the Fed tightened credit to put the brakes on inflation. Up. But that was offset by its simultaneous policy of lowering the rate at the discount window, thus encouraging banks to borrow new reserves to expand the money supply. Up. In 1924, the Fed suddenly created $500 million in new money. Within 1 year, the commercial banks parlayed that into more than $4 billion, an expansion of 8-to-1. The boom that followed took on the character of speculation rather than investment. Prices in the stock market rose drastically. Down. In 1926, the Florida land boom collapsed, and the economy began to contract once again. Up. In 1927, Montague Norman of the Bank of England visited the United States to consult with Benjamin Strong. Shortly after his visit, the Fed pumped new money into the system and the boom returned. Down. In the spring of 1928, the Fed contracted credit to halt the boom. Up. But the banks shifted their reserves into time deposits, where customers agree to wait before withdrawing their money. Since time deposits require a smaller reserve ratio than demand deposits, the banks were able to issue more loans than before. That offset the Fed's contraction of credit. Up. By that time, the British government had consumed its previous subsidy, which was used to maintain its welfare state. In the spring of 1928, the pound sterling was again sagging on the international market, and gold began to flow back into the United States. Once again, the fledgling creature came to the aid of the Bank of England, its ailing parent. The Fed bought a huge volume of the bankers' acceptances to depress interest rates and halt the flow of gold. The money supply suddenly increased by almost $2 billion. Down. In August, the Fed reversed its expansionist policy by selling treasury bonds in the open market and raising interest rates. The money supply began to contract. It was the final bubble. Sixth reason to abolish the Fed. One of the myths about the Federal Reserve is that it is needed to stabilize the economy. Yet it has achieved just the opposite. Destabilization is dramatically clear in the years prior to the crash, but the same cause and effect continues to this day. As long as men are given the power to tinker with the money supply, they will strive to circumvent the natural laws of supply and demand. No matter how high their intentions or pure their motives, they will cause disruptions in the natural flow. When these disruptions are perceived, they will try to compensate by causing opposite disruptions. But long before they act, there will already be new forces at work which they cannot, in all their wisdom, perceive until they are already manifest. It is the height of egotistical folly for experts to think they can outsmart or do better than the combined interactive decisions of hundreds of millions of people all acting in response to their own best judgment. Thus, the Fed is doomed to failure by its nature and its mission. That is the sixth reason it should be abolished. It destabilizes the economy. Tulipomania. Easy credit was not the only problem in this period. Equally important was the effect that had on the behavior patterns of the populace. Responding to herd instinct and a belief in the possibility of something for nothing, men were driven to the most bizarre form of investment speculation. This was not the first time such hysteria had seized a population. One of the most graphic examples occurred in Holland between the years 1634 and 1636. It came to pass that a new, rare flower, called the tulip, was discovered in the gardens of some of the more wealthy inhabitants of Constantinople, now known as Istanbul. When the root bulbs of these exotic blossoms were brought into Holland, they rapidly became a status symbol among the wealthy, much as racehorses or rare breeds of dogs are today in our own society, and those with surplus funds found that an investment in tulips brought them significant social recognition. The price of tulip bulbs climbed steadily until they became not merely symbols of status, but speculative investments as well. At one point, prices doubled every few days, and speculators were seen everywhere amassing great fortunes with no input of either labor or service. Many otherwise prudent people found themselves infected by the hysteria. They borrowed against their homes and invested their life savings to get in on the anticipated windfall. This pushed up prices even further and tended to create the fulfillment of its own prophecy. Contracts for the future delivery of tulip bulbs, a form of today's commodity market, became a dominant feature of Holland's stock market. Tulip bulbs eventually became more precious than gemstones. As new varieties were developed, the market became more complex, requiring experts to certify their origin and their grade. Prices soared, and the herd went insane. One bulb of the species called Admiral Liefken was valued at 4,400 florins, a Semper Augustus worth 5,500 florins was purchased for a new carriage, two gray horses, and a complete set of harnesses. It was recorded that at one sale a single viceroy brought two lasts of wheat, four lasts of rye, four fat oxen, eight fat swine, 12 fat sheep, two hogsheads of wine, four casks of butter, 1,000 pounds of cheese, a bed and mattress, a suit of clothes, and a silver drinking cup. Then, one day, without warning, reality returned from her 2-year vacation. By that time, everyone knew, deep in their hearts, that the spiraling prices bore no honest relationship to the value of the tulips, and that sooner or later, someone was going to get hurt. But they continued to speculate for fear of being too quick in their timing and losing out on profits yet to come. Everyone was confident they would sell out precisely at the top of the market. In any herd, however, there are always a few who will take the lead, and by 1636, all it took was one or two prominent merchants to sell out their stock. Overnight, there were no buyers whatsoever at any price. The tulip market vanished, and speculators by the thousands saw their dreams of easy wealth, and in many cases their life savings also, disappear with it. Tulipomania, as it was called at the time, had come to an end. Or did it? As we have seen, the Federal Reserve can create large amounts of money simply by going into the open market and buying debt contracts. But once it is in the mainstream of the economy, commercial banks can multiply that money by up to a factor of 9, and that is where the real inflationary action is. To protect that privilege is one of the reasons the banks formed this cartel in the first place. Nevertheless, the public still has the final say. If no one wants to borrow their money, the game is over. That possibility is more theoretical than real. Although men may be hesitant to go into debt for legitimate business ventures in times of economic uncertainty, they can be lured by easy credit to take a long shot. Dreams of instant wealth are powerful motivators. Gaming casinos, poker parlors, racetracks, lottery windows, and other forms of tulipomania are convincing evidence that the lust for gambling is embedded in genetic code. The public has always been interested in free corn. Tulips in the stock market. During the final phase of America's credit expansion of the 1920s, the rise in prices on the stock market was entirely speculative. Buyers did not care if their stocks were overpriced compared to the dividends they paid. Commonly traded issues were selling for 20 to 50 times their earnings. Some traded at 100. Speculators acquired stock merely to hold for a while and then sell at a profit. It was the greater fool strategy. No matter how high the price is today, there will be a greater fool tomorrow who will buy at an even higher price. For a while, that strategy seemed to work. To make the game even more exciting, it was common for investors to purchase their stocks on margin. That means the buyer puts up a small amount of money as a deposit, the margin, and borrows the rest from his stockbroker, who gets it from the bank, which gets it from the Fed. In the 1920s, the margin for small investors was as low as 10%. Although the average stock yielded a modest 3% annual dividend, speculators were willing to pay over 12% interest on their loans, meaning their stock had to appreciate about 9% per year just to break even. These margin accounts are sometimes referred to as call loans because the broker has the right to call them in on very short notice, often as short as 24 hours. If the broker calls the loan, the investor must produce the money immediately. If he cannot, the broker will obtain the money by selling the stock. In theory, the sale of the stock will be sufficient to cover the loan. But in practice, about the only time brokers call their loans is when the market is tumbling. Under those conditions, the stock cannot be sold except at a loss, a total loss of the investor's margin, and a variable loss to the broker, depending on the severity of the price fall. To obtain even more leverage, investors sometimes use the stocks they already own as collateral for a margin loan on new stocks. Therefore, if they cannot cover a margin call on their new stocks, they will lose their old stocks as well. In any event, such silly concerns were not in vogue in the 1920s. From August of 1921 to September of 1929, the Dow Jones Industrial Stock Price Average went from 63.9 to 381.17, a rise of 597%. Credit was abundant, loans were cheap, profits were big. Banks become speculators. The commercial banks were the middlemen in this giddy game. By the end of the decade, they were functioning more like speculators than banks. Instead of serving as dependable clearinghouses for money, they also had become players in the market. Loans to commercial enterprises for the production of goods and services, which normally are the backbone of sound banking practice, were losing ground to loans for speculating in the stock market and in urban real estate. Between 1921 and 1929, while commercial loans remained constant, total bank loans increased from $24.12 billion to $35.711 million. Loans on securities and real estate rose nearly $8 billion. Thus, about 70% of the increase during this period was in speculative investments, and that money was created by the banks. New York banks and trust companies had over $7 billion on loan to brokers at the New York Stock Exchange for use in margin accounts. Before the war, there were 250 securities dealers. By 1929, that number had grown to 6,500. The banks not only generated the money for speculation, they became speculators themselves by purchasing large blocks of high-yield bonds, many of which were of dubious quality. Those were the kinds of securities that are difficult to liquidate in a declining market. Borrowing money on short-term and investing on long-term, the banks were maneuvering themselves into a precarious position. Did the Federal Reserve cause the speculation in the stock market? Of course not. Speculators did that. The Fed undoubtedly had other objects in mind, but that did not cancel its responsibility. It was acutely aware of the psychological effect of easy credit and had consciously used that knowledge to manipulate public behavior on numerous occasions. Behavioral psychology is a necessary tool of the trade, so it could claim neither ignorance nor innocence. In the unfolding of this tragedy, it was about as innocent as a spider whose web accidentally caught the fly. The Final Bubble. In the spring of 1928, the Federal Reserve expressed concern over speculation in the stock market and raised interest rates to curb the expansion of credit. The growth in the money supply began to slow down, and so did the rise in stock prices. It is conceivable that the soaring economy could have been brought in for a soft landing, except that there were other agendas to be considered. Professor Quigley had said that the central bankers were not substantive powers unto themselves, but were as marionettes whose strings were pulled by others. Just as the speculation spree appeared to be coming under control, those strings were yanked and the Federal Reserve flip-flopped once again. The strings originated in London. Even after 7 years of subsidy by the Federal Reserve, the British economy was sagging from the weight of its socialist system, and gold was moving back into the United States. The Fed, in spite of its own public condemnation of excessive speculation, reversed itself at the brink of success and purchased over $300 million of bankers' acceptances in the last half of 1928, which caused an increase in the money supply of almost $2 billion. Professor Rothbard says, "Europe, as we have noted, had found the benefits from the 1927 inflation dissipated, and European opinion now clamored against any tighter money in the U.S. The easing in late 1928 prevented gold inflows into the U.S. from getting very large. Great Britain was again losing gold, and sterling was weak once more. The United States bowed once again to its overriding wish to see Europe avoid the inevitable consequences of its own inflationary policies." Prior to the Fed's reversal of policy, stock prices had actually declined by 5%. Now they went through the roof, rising 20% from July to December. The boom had returned in spades. Then, in February of 1929, a curious event occurred. Montague Norman traveled to the United States once again to confer privately with the officers of the Federal Reserve. He also met with Andrew Mellon, Secretary of the Treasury. There is no detailed public record of what transpired at these closed meetings, but we can be certain of three things. It was important. It concerned the economies of America and Great Britain, and it was thought best not to tell the public what was going on. It is not unreasonable to surmise that the central bankers had come to the conclusion that the bubble, not only in America, but in Europe, was probably going to rupture very soon. Rather than fight it as they had in the past, it was time to stand back and let it happen, clear out the speculators, and return the markets to reality. As Galbraith put it, "How much better, as seen from the Federal Reserve, to let nature take its course and thus allow nature to take the blame?" Mellon was even more emphatic. Herbert Hoover described Mellon's views as follows. "Mr. Mellon had only one formula: liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate the farmers, liquidate real estate." He insisted that when the people get an inflation brainstorm, the only way to get it out of their blood is to let it collapse. He held that even a panic was not altogether a bad thing. He said it will purge the rottenness out of the system. High costs of living and high living will come down. People will work harder, live a moral life. Values will be adjusted, and enterprising people will pick up the wrecks from less competent people. If this had been the mindset between Mellon and Norman and the Federal Reserve Board, the purpose of their meetings would have been to make sure that when the implosion happened, the central banks could coordinate their policies. Rather than be overwhelmed by it, they should direct it as best they can and turn it ultimately to their advantage. Perhaps we shall never know if that scenario is accurate, but the events that followed strongly support such a view. Advance warning for members only. Immediately after the meetings, the monetary scientists began to issue warnings to their colleagues in the financial fraternity to get out of the market. On February 6th, the Federal Reserve issued an advisory to its member banks to liquidate their holdings in the stock market. The following month, Paul Warburg gave the same advice in the annual report to the stockholders of his International Acceptance Bank. He explained the reason for that advice. If the orgies of unrestrained speculation are permitted to spread, the ultimate collapse is certain not only to affect the speculators themselves, but to bring about a general depression involving the entire country. Paul Warburg was a partner with Kuhn Loeb & Company, which maintained a list of preferred customers. These were fellow bankers, wealthy industrialists, prominent politicians, and high officials in foreign governments. A similar list was maintained at J.P. Morgan Company. It was customary to give these men advance notice on important stock issues and an opportunity to purchase them at 2 to 15 points below their price to the public. That was one of the means by which investment bankers maintained influence over the affairs of the world. The men on these lists were notified of the coming crash. John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Joseph P. Kennedy, Bernard Baruch, Henry Morgenthau, Douglas Dillon. The biographies of all the Wall Street giants at that time boast that these men were wise enough to get out of the stock market just before the crash. And it is true. Virtually all of the inner club was rescued. There is no record of any member of the interlocking directorate between the Federal Reserve, the major New York banks, and their prime customers having been caught by surprise. Wisdom, apparently, was greatly affected by whose list one was on. A message of comfort to the public. While the crew was abandoning ship, the passengers were told it was a lovely cruise. President Coolidge and Treasury Secretary Mellon had been vociferous in their public utterances that the economy was in better shape than ever. From his socialist perch in London, John Maynard Keynes exclaimed that the management of the dollar by the Federal Reserve Board was a triumph of man over money. And from the plush offices of his New York Federal Reserve Bank, Benjamin Strong boasted, "The very existence of the Federal Reserve System is a safeguard against anything like a calamity growing out of money rates. In former days, the psychology was different because the facts of the banking situation were different. Mob panic, and consequently mob disaster, is less likely to arise." The public was comforted, and the balloon continued to expand. It was now time to sharpen the pin. On April 19th, the Fed held an emergency meeting under cloak of great secrecy. The following day, the New York Times reported as follows. "Reserve Council confers in haste. Atmosphere of mystery is thrown about its meeting in Washington." An atmosphere of deep mystery was thrown about the proceedings both by the board and the council. No advance announcement had been made that an extraordinary session of the council was contemplated, and the fact that the members were in the city became known only when newspaper correspondents happened to see some of them entering the Treasury Department building. Even after that, evasive replies were given. While the joint meeting was in progress at the Treasury Department, every effort was made to guard the proceedings, and a group of newspaper correspondents were asked to leave the corridor. Let us return briefly to Montague Norman. His biographer tells us that after he became head of the Bank of England, his custom was to journey to the United States several times each year, although his arrival was seldom noted by the press. He traveled in disguise, wearing a long black cloak and a large broad-brimmed hat, and he used the pseudonym of Professor Skinner. It was on one of those unpublicized trips that he ran into a young Australian by the name of W.C. Wentworth. 60 years later, Wentworth wrote a letter to The Australian, a newspaper in Sydney, and told of his encounter. "In 1929, I was a member of the Oxford and Cambridge athletic team, visiting America to run against American universities. Late in July, we split up to return, and I, together with some other members, boarded a smallish passenger vessel in New York. There were, of course, no transatlantic aeroplanes in those days. A fellow passenger was Mr. Skinner, and a member of our team recognized him. He was Montague Norman, returning to London after a secret visit to the U.S. Central Bank, traveling incognito. When we told him we knew who he was, he asked us not to blow his cover, because if the details of his movement were made public, it could have serious financial consequences. Naturally, we agreed, and on the days following, as we crossed the Atlantic, he talked to us very frankly. He said, "In the next few months there is going to be a shakeout, but don't worry, it won't last for long." On August 9th, just a few weeks after that shipboard encounter, the Federal Reserve Board reversed its easy credit policy and raised the discount rate to 6%. A few days later, the Bank of England raised its rate also. Bank reserves in both countries began to shrink, and along with them, so did the money supply. Simultaneously, the system began to sell securities in the open market, a maneuver that also contracts the money supply. Call rates on margin loans had jumped to 15, then 20%. The pin had been inserted. The duck dinner begins. The securities market reached its high point on September 19th. Then it began to slide. The public was not yet aware that the end had arrived. The roller coaster had dipped before. Surely it would shoot upward again. For 5 more weeks, the public bought heavily on the way down. More than 1 million shares were traded during that period. Then, on Thursday, October 24th, like a giant school of fish suddenly turning direction in response to an unseen signal, thousands of investors stampeded to sell. The ticker tape was hopelessly overloaded. Prices tumbled. 13 million shares exchanged hands. Everyone said the bottom had dropped out of the market. They were wrong. 5 days later, it did. On Tuesday, October 29th, the exchanges were crushed by an avalanche of selling. At times, there were no buyers at all. By the end of the trading session, over 16 million shares had been dumped, in most cases at any price that was offered. Within a single day, millions of investors were wiped out. Within a few weeks of further decline, $3 billion of wealth had disappeared. Within 12 months, $40 billion had vanished. People who had counted their paper profits and thought they were rich suddenly found themselves to be very poor. The other side of the coin is that for every seller, there was a buyer. The insiders who had moved their investments into cash and gold were the buyers. It must be remembered that falling stock prices didn't necessarily mean that there was anything wrong with the stocks. Those representing solid companies were still paying dividends and were good investments at a realistic price. In the panic, prices had tumbled far below their natural levels. Those who had the cash picked them up for a small fraction of their true worth. Giant holding companies were formed for that task, such as Marine Midland Corporation, the Lehman Corporation, and the Equity Corporation. J.P. Morgan set up the food trust called Standard Brands. Like the shark swallowing the mackerel, the big speculators devoured the small. There is no evidence that the crash was planned for the purpose of profit-taking. There was considerable motivation for the monetary scientists to avert it, and they might have done so had not their higher priority agendas gotten in the way. Yet once they realized the inevitability of a collapse in the market, they were not bashful about using their privileged position to take full advantage of it. In that sense, FDR's son-in-law, Curtis Dahl, was right when he wrote, "It was the calculated shearing of the public by the world money powers." Natural Law Number 5. Here is another of those natural laws of economics that needs to be added to our list. Lesson: it is human nature for man to place personal priorities ahead of all others. Even the best of men cannot long resist the temptation to benefit at the expense of their neighbors if the occasion is placed squarely before them. This is especially true when the means by which they benefit is obscure and not likely to be perceived as such. There may be exceptional men from time to time who can resist that temptation, but their numbers are small. The general rule will prevail in the long run. A managed economy presents men with precisely that kind of opportunity. The power to create and extinguish the nation's money supply provides unlimited potential for personal gain. Throughout history, the granting of that power has been justified as being necessary to protect the public. But the results have always been the opposite. It has been used against the public and for the personal gain of those who control. Therefore, law. When men are entrusted with the power to control the money supply, they will eventually use that power to confiscate the wealth of their neighbors. There is no better illustration of that law than the crash of 1929 and the lingering depression that followed.
You have reached the end of Disc 17.
From Crash to Depression. The lingering depression is an important part of the story. The speculators had been ruined, but what they lost was money acquired without effort. There were some unfortunate souls who also lost their life savings, but only because they gambled those savings on call loans. Those who bought stock with money they actually possessed did not have to sell, and they did quite well in the long run. For the most part, something for nothing had merely been converted back into nothing. The price of stocks had plummeted, but the companies behind them were still producing products, still employing people, and still paying dividends. No one lost his job just because the market fell. The tulips were gone, but the wheat crop remained. So where was the problem? In truth, there was none, at least not yet. The crash, as devastating as it was to the speculators, had little effect on the average American. Unemployment didn't become rampant until the Depression years, which came later, and were caused by continued government restraint of the free market. The drop of prices in the stock market was really a long overdue and healthy adjustment to the economy. The stage was now set for recovery and sound economic growth, as always had happened in the past. It did not happen this time. The monetary and political scientists who had created the problem now were in full charge of the rescue. They saw the crash as a golden opportunity to justify even more controls than before. Herbert Hoover launched a multitude of government programs to bolster wage rates, prevent prices from dropping, prop up failing firms, stimulate construction, guarantee home loans, protect the depositors, rescue the banks, subsidize the farmers, and provide public works. FDR was swept into office by promising even more of the same under the slogan of a New Deal. And the Federal Reserve launched a series of banking reforms, all of which were measures to further extend its power over the money supply. In 1931, fresh money was pumped into the economy to restart the cycle. But this time the rocket would not lift off. The dead weight of new bureaucracies and government regulations and subsidies and taxes and welfare benefits and deficit spending and tinkering with prices had kept it on the launching pad. Eventually, the productive foundation of the country also began to crumble under the weight. Taxes and regulatory agencies forced companies out of business. Those that remained had to curtail production. Unemployment began to spread. By every economic measure, the economy was no better or worse in 1939 than it was in 1930, when the rescue began. It wasn't until the outbreak of World War II and the tooling up for war production that followed that the Depression was finally brought to an end. It was a dubious save. In almost every way, it was a repeat of the drama played out with World War I, even to the names of two of its most important players. FDR and Churchill worked together behind the scenes to bring America into the conflict, Churchill wanting American assistance in a war England was losing and could not afford, FDR wanting a jolt to the economy for political reasons, and the financiers gathered behind J.P. Morgan wanting the profits of war. But that is another chapter, and this book is long enough. What happened after World War II was the focus of the first six chapters. That brings us to the end of the historical record. It's time now to reset the coordinates on our time machine and return to the present. Summary. Congress had been assured that the Federal Reserve Act would decentralize banking power away from Wall Street. However, within a few years of its inception, the system was controlled by the New York Reserve Bank under the leadership of Benjamin Strong, whose name was synonymous with the Wall Street Money Trust. During the 9 years before the crash of 1929, the Federal Reserve was responsible for a massive expansion of the money supply. A primary motive for that policy was to assist the government of Great Britain to pay for its socialist programs, which, by then, had drained its treasury. By devaluing the dollar and depressing interest rates in America, investors would move their money to England, where rates and values were higher. That strategy succeeded in helping Great Britain for a while, but it set in motion the forces that made the stock market crash inevitable. The money supply expanded throughout this period, but the trend was interspersed with short spasms of contraction, which were the result of attempts to halt the expansions. Each resolve to use restraint was broken by the higher political agenda of helping the governments of Europe. In the long view, the result of plentiful money and easy credit was a wave of speculation in the stock market and urban real estate that intensified with each passing month. There is circumstantial evidence that the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve had concluded at a secret meeting in February of 1929 that a collapse in the market was inevitable and that the best action was to let nature take its course. Immediately after that meeting, the financiers sent advisory warnings to lists of preferred customers, wealthy industrialists, prominent politicians, and high officials in foreign governments, to get out of the stock market. Meanwhile, the American people were being assured that the economy was in sound condition. On August 9th, the Federal Reserve applied the pin to the bubble. It increased the bank loan rate and began to sell securities in the open market. Both actions have the effect of reducing the money supply. Rates on brokers' loans jumped to 20%. On October 29th, the stock market collapsed. Thousands of investors were wiped out in a single day. The insiders who were forewarned had converted their stocks into cash while prices were still high. They now became the buyers. Some of the greatest fortunes in America were made in that fashion. Section 6. Time Travel into the Future. In the previous sections of this book, we have traveled through time. We began our journey by stepping into the past. As we crisscrossed the centuries, we observed wars, treachery, profiteering, and political deception. That has brought us to the present. Now we are prepared to ride our time machine into the future. It will be a hair-raising trip, and much of what lies ahead will be unpleasant. But it has not yet come to pass. It is merely the projection of present forces. If we do not like what we see, we still have an opportunity to change those forces. The future will be what we choose to make it. Chapter 24. Doomsday Mechanisms. The decline of American prosperity, the increase in the size of government, the decrease in personal freedom, the growth of taxes, evidence that this is according to plan by an elite ruling group which hopes to merge the United States into world government on the basis of equality with less developed nations. The environmentalist movement shown to be an outgrowth of that plan. That's enough history for one book. It now is time to reset the coordinates on our time machine and jump into the future. Before activating that switch, let's take one last look around us. The future is molded by the present. Where we are now will affect where we are going to be. Mired in debt. One of the most obvious characteristics of our present time is that we are mired in debt. Federal deficits have grown steadily since 1950, and the rate of growth is in a vertical climb. It took 198 years for the government to borrow the first $1 trillion, Then, in just 12 years, mostly under the Reagan administration, it borrowed another $3 trillion. By the first year of the George W. Bush administration, even before the terrorist attack on September 11th, the federal debt had risen to over $5.8 trillion. By 2010, it had risen to $202 trillion when all liabilities are included. It is difficult to comprehend such numbers. If you had a stack of $100 bills 40 inches high, you would be a millionaire. $202 trillion would rise over 127,000 miles into space. By the time you read this, after the expenditures of the subsequent CFR administrations, it will touch the moon. By 2006, gross interest payments on the national debt were running $406 billion per year. That consumed about 17% of all federal revenue. It now represents the government's largest single expense, greater than defense, larger than the combined cost of the Departments of Agriculture, Education, Energy, Housing and Urban Development, Interior, Justice, Labor, State, Transportation, and Veterans Affairs. These charges are not paid by the government. They are paid by you. You provide the money through taxes and inflation. The cost currently is about $5,000 for each family of four. All families pay through inflation, but not all pay taxes. The cost to each tax-paying family, therefore, is higher. On average, over $5,000 is extracted from your family each year, not to provide government services or even to pay off previous debt. Nothing is produced by it, not even roads or government buildings. No welfare or medical benefits come out of it. No salaries are paid by it. The nation's standard of living is not raised by it. It does nothing except pay interest. Furthermore, the interest is compounded, which means even if the government were to completely stop its deficit spending, the total debt would continue to grow as a result of interest on that portion which already exists. In 2010, interest on the national debt was already consuming 44% of all the revenue collected by personal income taxes. Amazing, isn't it? Without interest on the national debt, we would save enough to cut our personal income taxes by a third, and we could reduce corporate taxes as well. Unfortunately, under present policies and programs, that is not going to happen because Congress does not live within its income. Many expenses are paid not from taxes, but from selling government bonds and going deeper into debt each year. So even though we could save enough to slash personal income taxes, it would not be enough. The government would still go into the red to keep up its present lifestyle. However, if a reduction in the size and scope of the bureaucracy were accomplished at the same time, personal and corporate income taxes could be eliminated, and the government would have an annual surplus. The Doomsday Mechanism. Unfortunately, the locomotive is running in the opposite direction. Government is growing larger, not smaller. By 2008, outlays of the federal government were one-fourth the nation's economy. Nearly twice as many people now work for government than for manufacturing companies in the private sector. There are more bank regulators than bankers, more Farm Bureau workers than farmers, more welfare administrators than recipients. More citizens receive government checks than those who pay income taxes. By 1996, welfare benefits in 29 states were higher than the average secretary's wage. And in 6 states, they were more than the entry-level wage for computer programmers. When people can vote for the transfer of wealth to themselves, the ballot box becomes a weapon by which the majority plunders the minority. That is the point of no return, the point where the doomsday mechanism begins to accelerate until the system self-destructs. The plundered grow weary of carrying the load and eventually join the plunderers. In the end, only the state remains. The doomsday mechanism is also operating within government itself. By 2010, the average federal worker was earning 60% more than the average worker in the private sector. By 1992, more than half of all federal outlays went for entitlements. Those are expenses, Medicare, Social Security, and retirement programs, based on promises of future payments. That does not mean they cannot be eliminated. For example, entitlements include $24 billion per year for food stamps. There is no contractual obligation to continue those, only political expediency. By now, most Americans have stood in grocery lines and watched the well-dressed customer in front of them use food stamps for ice cream and pretzels, pay cash for two bottles of wine, and then drive away in a late-model car. The political function of the food stamp program is not to help the hungry, but to buy votes. The programs that do involve contractual obligations, such as Social Security and Medicare, could be turned over to private firms, which would not only operate them more efficiently, but also would pay out higher benefits. Congress, however, does not dare to touch any of these entitlements for fear of losing votes. Normally, with contracts for future obligations of this kind, the issuer is required by law to accumulate money into a fund to make sure that there will be enough available when future payments become due. The federal government does not abide by those laws. The funds exist on paper only. The money that comes in for future obligations is immediately spent and replaced by a government IOU. So, as those future payments come due, all of the money must come from revenue being collected at that time. Herein lies the doomsday mechanism. These obligations will be paid out of future taxes or inflation. Entitlements currently represent 52% of all federal outlays, and they are growing at the rate of 12% each year. When this is added to the 14% that is now being spent for interest payments on the national debt, we come to the startling conclusion that two-thirds of all federal expenses are now entirely automatic, and that percentage is growing each month. Even if Congress were to stop all of the spending programs in the normal budget, dismantle the armed forces, close down all of its agencies and bureaus, stop all of its subsidies, and board up all of its buildings, including the White House, it would be able to reduce its present spending by only one-third. And even that small amount is shrinking by 10 to 12% per year. That is a best-case scenario. The real case is that Congress is accelerating its discretionary spending, not canceling it. One does not have to be a statistical analyst to figure out where this trend is headed. The biggest doomsday mechanism of all, however, is the Federal Reserve System. It will be recalled that every cent of our money supply, including coins, currency, and checkbook money, came into being for the purpose of being lent to someone. All of those dollars will disappear when the loans are paid back. They will exist only so long as the debt behind them exists. Underneath the pyramid of money, supporting the entire structure, are the so-called reserves which represent the Fed's monetization of debt. If we tried to pay off the national debt, those reserves also would start to disappear, and our money supply would be undermined. The Fed would have to scramble into the world money markets and replace U.S. security with bonds from corporations and other countries. Technically, that can be done, but the effect would be devastating. Congress would be fearful to eliminate the national debt, even if it wanted to. These are the doomsday mechanisms in operation. If we do not understand how they function, we will not be prepared for our trip into the future. The scenes that will unfold there will appear too bizarre, the events too shocking. We would be convinced that something surely had gone wrong with our time machine. Who owns the national debt? It has been said that we need not worry about interest on the national debt because we owe it to ourselves. Let's take a look at who owes what to whom. The Fed, for many years, held only about 9% of the national debt. Agencies of the federal government held 28%. Foreign investors owned approximately 43%, 2002 figures, and private sector investors in the U.S. held the balance. By 2010, foreign investors had lost confidence in the U.S. ability to make good on its IOUs and ceased to bid on treasury auctions. The Fed was obligated to monetize the difference, create money out of nothing, and by August was purchasing 80% of the debt. It is partly true that we owe it to ourselves, but it is more accurate to say that all of us owe it to some of us. The some of us are private investors seeking income that is exempt from state income taxes, and large institutions such as banks, corporations, insurance companies, and investment funds. With institutions, the money represents pooled assets belonging to thousands of small investors. So a major portion of the interest on the national debt does indeed accrue to the benefit of a large sector of the American people. That's the good news. The bad news is that the government obtains every cent of the money it pays to us by confiscating it from us in the first place. If it is true that we owe it to ourselves, then it is also true that we pay it to ourselves. The money goes out of one pocket back into the other, minus a handling fee. The government takes $1,000 from us in taxes and inflation and gives us back $350. The so-called benefit to the public is an illusion. And more bad news. When people purchase government bonds, there is less money available for investment in private industry. It is well known that government credit crowds out private credit. The result is that the productive side of the nation is handicapped by unfair competition for investment capital. To obtain new money for growth, private companies must pay higher interest rates. These are passed on to the consumer in the form of higher prices. Many companies are forced to curtail their plans for expansion, and potentially new jobs are never created. Some companies are forced out of business altogether, and their employees are put out of work. The economy is always retarded by government debt. The larger the debt, the greater the damage. The 43% portion of the national debt held by foreign investors is a huge bite. $1,300,000,000 cannot be ignored. These bonds could become a serious problem down the line as they mature. So far, they have been a partial blessing because they were purchased with money that already existed. Therefore, they were not inflationary. But it is not difficult to imagine future conditions under which bondholders would decide not to renew. What would happen if the stability of the government were to be questioned, or if the productive capacity of the United States were to be challenged by massive terrorist attacks? In order to pay off those bonds on maturity, the Treasury would have to issue new ones. The Federal Reserve would have to purchase the new bonds with fiat money. Therefore, foreign-held federal debt is a ticking time bomb. If it should ever have to be picked up by the Fed, the inflationary impact on our country would be staggering. What difference does it make? There is a tendency to read about these trends with a kind of detached fascination. Isn't that interesting? But where is the relevance? Why get excited over such technicalities and abstractions? So what if the government is mired in debt? Who cares if the interest will never be paid? What of it if we have a world currency or a world government? What difference will any of it make to me? The first step toward answering those questions is to see what difference it already has made. Our upcoming trip into the future will merely extend those lines. Based on doomsday predictions of environmental disaster, government has saddled private companies with such burdensome expenses for eliminating waste products that heavy industry, once the mainstay of American prosperity, has fled our shores. Because of concern over the habitat of the spotted owl and the desert kangaroo rat, millions of acres of timber and agricultural land have been taken out of production. High taxes, unrealistic rules for safety devices in the workplace, the so-called fair employment practices, and mandatory health insurance are rapidly destroying what is left of America's private industry. The result is unemployment and dislocation for millions of American workers. Federal taxes, including Social Security, now take more than 40% of our private incomes. State, county, and local taxes are on top of that. Inflation feeds on what is left. We spend half of each year working for the government. A study by the AFL-CIO in 1977 revealed that in spite of wage increases in terms of dollars, the real wages of the average American, in terms of what he can buy with those dollars,